afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Goff. I'm lawyer for the appellant, Maurice Ross, in this case. Factually and procedurally, what happened in this matter was a suppression hearing before trial in the Superior Court, at which point the defendant challenged the lawfulness of the detention that was conducted by the police in this case. Essentially, what we have here is an anonymous tip of an individual wearing gray pants who was, according to the tipster, dealing drugs at a certain location in the city of Wilmington. The police responded to that location, and at that point they observed a large African-American male, 6'3", 300 pounds, wearing gray pants. He wasn't doing anything. Essentially, he was just walking. Police made eye contact with him. He made eye contact with them. They testified that he appeared to be aware of their presence. At that point in time, he turned and walked in an unhurried fashion away. The police stopped their cruiser. The uniformed officers got out of their cruiser. And immediately, Officer Villaverde, along with Officer Brown, began to pursue the defendant, Mr. Ross. And as soon, according to the testimony, as they left the cruiser, Officer Villaverde immediately began saying, "Can I speak to you?" or words to that effect. According to the testimony of Officer Brown, this request was made, as she put it, the whole time that they pursued him. They indicated in their testimony that at the time that they left their vehicle, the appellant, Mr. Ross, was 30 to 40 feet away, and that they walked quickly to close the distance between them. During that point in time, and as they approached the appellant, he apparently approached an older gentleman on the street, said something to him. The older gentleman backed away from him, and the appellant tried to reach out and give the older gentleman an object with a cupped hand. At that point, the officers specifically stated, "Stop," and Officer Brown specifically stated, "Stop," and then at that point, when he did not stop, he was essentially tackled to the ground.
Does this case turn on when the seizure took place?
That's exactly what it turns on. The trial judge, Your Honor, the trial judge determined in his oral ruling that the seizure occurred, for purposes of this court, I can say, at the point in time where Officer Brown said stop and grabbed the arm of the defendant.
Before the handoff?
I don't think there actually was a handoff.
Or
that
they
actually,
attempted handoff.
They had attempted handoff as it was sort of taking place. We're arguing, Your Honor, the appellant is arguing, that the seizure under Jones and the standards of Jones, where it is a reasonable person in the appellant situation, their belief, what they would reasonably believe their freedom was at that point, we're arguing that essentially that happened during the course in time where Officer Villaverde and Officer Brown, after they had left their vehicle and were following him and repeatedly saying, "Can I speak to you?" All that time, according to the testimony, Mr. Ross, the appellant, was ignoring their requests.
Can I interrupt for a second, because I want to be clear about the fact and the what happened when. When your client was walking away and the police had now exited their car and were catching up to him saying, you know, "I want to talk to you, can I talk to you?" And your client was ignoring that request and continuing on his way away from the police, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then at a certain point, while this is going on, your client comes upon an elderly person and stops at that point there's some back and forth between the two of them. There's an attempt to hand the elderly person something, and the elderly person refuses it. And it is after that happens that the police come up to your client and say stop and put their hand on his arm. Is that the sequence?
I think, Your Honor, that what happens first is that there's verbal conversation that is not described in any other way than just it appeared that they were saying that my client was saying something to the elderly person.
Right.
That the elderly person then backed up away from him, and that at that point he was reaching out with one hand. The officer indicated that he lost sight of that hand, and then at that point the officer indicates that that she said stop, and pretty much simultaneously they grabbed a hold of his hand and a hold of him and stopped him.
But so this was after your client had made some sort of gesture of something cupped in his hand or apparently cupped in his hand and reaching out toward the elderly person, correct?
At that point where they declared stop?
Yeah.
I believe so.
Okay.
I believe that that's what the record would reflect.
Okay.
But our argument doesn't really hinge on that. Our argument hinges mainly on whether or not Your Honors believe or rule differently than Judge Herlihy did, that the detention occurred at a point where Officer Villaverde, a uniformed officer, asks to speak to my client. He ignores it and then repeats it and repeats it and repeats it until as they're walking that distance, because they've got to cover some distance in order to get together.
So is it your contention that the first time the question was asked was a seizure?
I wouldn't say that it's necessary for the court to rule that way, and I guess it is necessary for me, however, to answer your question. At the risk of prejudicing my client, I would say that it wouldn't necessarily be the first time. But I think that after a person ignores something, and one of the things that I would hope that the court would consider is the fact that that there was eye contact between between the police officer and the appellant even before they got out of the car. There was testimony to that effect. And so the officer knew that he knew that they were looking at him and considering him. So at a point in time where the officer then says, after he's gotten out of his car, and says, can I talk to you, and the gentleman ignores him the first time around, well, maybe that's not a detention then, but as the officer proceeds to continue to follow him, I apologize, I'm used to being in a trial court, I move around a little bit, but as the officer continues to follow him at that point and continues to ask him that question, what I would submit to the court is that the only answer he was going to accept would be actual submission, because the answer of being ignored was not being accepted by the police officer, and that a reasonable person in Mr. Ross's circumstances would not have believed that he was free to go. The reason why he kept on going is pretty clear. He was carrying drugs, and he wanted to get rid of it because he knew these people were going to stop him.
Your argument is based in part on the language from Terry about a show of authority in some way restraining the liberty of an individual, and not a necessity of physical force restraining the individual.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that it is, and I relied on Jones, and that is that it was under these circumstances a reasonable person would believe that these acts of the police officer in following him and continuing to ask him questions, ask him to speak, even after he was not stopping and ignoring them, would have made a reasonable person believe that that police officer was trying to stop him, was trying to detain him.
Well, doesn't that argument actually work just as well in the opposite side? In other words, the police are not particularly delicate by and large, and if they want to stop somebody, they know how to stop somebody. And instead of taking that kind of action, they merely are trying to catch up to the person. Obviously, they do want to talk to the person. But it would appear that they didn't believe they could just stop the person until something else transpired. So all they were doing is saying, I'd like to speak to you. Can I speak to you? Can I speak to you? And your client was continuing to walk and ignore them. And if your client had continued and gotten to a friendly home to walk in the front door, he would have opened the door, closed the door, and the police would be standing outside.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I would submit that that just wasn't going to happen. That these officers were not going to let him walk away, whether he approached the older gentleman or not. I'm not sure if I've answered your question or not.
Well, the question is whether it's what's in the police officer's mind about what they're planning to do under the circumstances that's the focus of our attention, or whether it's the ultimate defendant and what's in his mind about either the extent to which physical force is being used to restrain him or a show of authority is being used to restrain him. Now, which is the focus?
Well, Your Honor, the legal focus and the specific legal issue is whether a reasonable person in the defendant's position would have believed that he was not free to go. And that would be the point in time where a detention for Fourth Amendment purposes take place. However, I believe that...
So when did it happen? When did the detention happen? You said it wasn't the first question.
I would say probably the second time.
The second time it was asked? Sir, can we talk to you? Is a detention?
I would submit that under these circumstances that at that point in time where they've been ignored once and the gentleman's walked away and they're continuing to follow him, that the second time that they ask him and he continues to walk away, that would be sufficient point.
Is there anything in the record that your client, in following any one of these questions, looked back and then turned away and kept on walking?
There is nothing in the record that says that.
Well, then why isn't it reasonable to infer that your client did not hear the question, or at least some of the questions?
I would submit that the reason why it wouldn't be reasonable to do that, Your Honor, is because the testimony Officer Brown was that Officer Villaverde was saying it loudly and that they weren't very far away from each other. And furthermore, the defendant knew that the police officers had gotten, had stopped, had made eye contact with them, and was following after them. That's, I would submit that. And also, basically, it was just the loudness of him calling out and the repeated nature of it. I don't think that it would be reasonable under those circumstances for the court to believe that he wasn't actually ignoring them. So, and to follow up further on the Chief Justice's question.
Your position, that's the only inference that could be drawn from the evidence?
I think it's the only reasonable inference that can be drawn, Your Honor. But to follow up on Your Honor's question, you had asked me what the police officer's state of mind had to do with it as well. And I had said that the legal question was, you know, what a reasonable person in the defendant's position would believe. But I think there's also some support in the law that an officer's intent is relevant to a determination of the reasonableness of a defendant's belief.
Let's assume that they were not walking, but they were in a police car and driving the police car next to your client as he's walking. And the window is rolled down, and they say, "Sir, can we talk to you? Sir, can we talk to you?" And he keeps on going. Is there a seizure then?
I think so.
Well, then why is that not controlled by Chesternut? Chesternut is where the police cruiser is alongside a running pedestrian.
Right.
And the U.S. Supreme Court said that that is not a seizure after noting that there was no command to stop, no display of a weapon, no blocking with the vehicle, no siren, no lights.
Your Honor, perhaps if he just remained in the cruiser, it would be a different story. And perhaps I would change my viewpoint, because obviously the Supreme Court ruled otherwise. But I would submit that with the officers actually getting out of the motor vehicle and then pursuing the defendant and closing distance between the two and making the request, that is a significant distinction that in the defendant's own mind would cause him to reasonably believe that these officers weren't going to stop until such time as he stopped.
But does our Jones case purport to be in lockstep with federal constitutional law, or is it based on an interpretation of the Delaware Constitution?
Well, Jones is a Delaware case, and it also is based upon our own constitutional Fourth Amendment, but unreasonable search and seizure law. And specifically, it determines that we have greater protection under the Delaware Constitution than under the federal Constitution. I think that federally, as I understand it, the requirement is that there has to be an actual submission to authority or an actual detention for anything for the Fourth Amendment to be implicated. However, under Delaware's law, I think that I believe it was Justice Holland that wrote this opinion. I apologize for not remembering.
Chief Justice Easy.
Oh, well, then I am incorrect. I apologize.
Gone but not forgotten.
And in that case, I think that there was some mention of the fact that the court's view was that in a closed case, the doubt should be given or the benefit of the doubt should be given to the defendant in such circumstances.
And, well, the benefit of the doubt on what issue?
On the issue of whether or not a detention has taken place and whether or not...
it might make sense if the benefit of the doubt was given on what he subjectively believed about whether there had been physical force or a show of authority reasonable enough to have him assume he was or seized or about to be seized. Is that what you mean?
I think so, Your Honor. I think so.
Help us by articulating your rule. If the police said stop and he stopped, but then you could argue he submitted to a show of authority and he was seized. In this particular case, they never said stop.
Correct.
And he never stopped. And so the state's argument is they said they'd like to speak to him. He disregarded the request. They never made a show of force, and he never yielded to a show of force. Therefore, there was no stop until they saw him trying to do something, and then that added to their concern, and they seized his arm and stopped him at that point. So tell us, preceding touching the arm, what was the demonstration of force, and what was the submission to a show of force?
I don't think there was a show of force, Your Honor. I think it is a show of authority on the police. And police officers, I think, have just pretty much inherent authority when they're on the street wearing their uniform. And when they approach a group of people or approach a person and say they want to speak to them, in and of itself, I would submit there is a certain level, maybe not enough for a detention to take place, but there is a certain level of coercion, or not coercion, but show of authority. But when that happens repeatedly to a person that they don't have a reasonable suspicion to speak to, that at a certain point in time, and perhaps it's after the second request by that officer, as that person is walking away, as he says it loudly to that person who is ignoring it, that at that point in time, that show of authority would make a reasonable person believe that they had to stop. And furthermore, I think the rationale of the rule that we're submitting to the court is that you can't goad, the police cannot goad someone into behavior that is going to cause them to send, at that point in time, actually have a factual or reasonable basis to stop by engaging.
Let me ask you this. Change the facts a little bit. Assume your client is standing still, and the same information is given. Man in a gray pants is dealing drugs and at such and such a location. The police arrive. Your client doesn't move, tries to hand something to somebody who's this elderly man who's right there. The elderly man backs off, as in this case. Is there a reasonable, articulable suspicion there where your client hasn't even moved and they haven't said anything until that point?
Is Your Honor saying is there a reasonable suspicion at the point in time where he reaches out and gives the
drugs? After they observe this, they're walking up to him, he hasn't moved, but they have seen him attempt to hand off something with a cupped hand.
I would say that once they saw him try to hand something off, there was reasonable suspicion.
Okay, so if we factor out the walking away, which can't be considered under Jones,
right?
Isn't that exactly what we have here?
That's exactly what we have if Your Honor's determined that the detention occurred at the point in time where, at that point in time, at the point in time where the stop takes place. Because under Your Honor's, if I understood your hypothetical correctly, you said that there was no conversation. There was nothing said by the police officer. So if you take that out of the picture, then I would agree with you. You don't have any show of authority.
Let's change the hypothetical then. They're walking up and they say, "Sir, can we talk to you?" He doesn't move, attempts to hand it off to somebody else.
To be consistent with a prior questioning by Your Honor, I would have to say that there was no detention at that point because that was only one request. But if the officer continued to ask the question and nothing happened and a period of time passed, I would submit that there is a show of authority and the officer is simply not getting the answer that he wants. Maybe he's being polite about it, but he is detaining that person. He's not going to stop until such time as the individual says, "Fine, I'll talk to you," or until they bolt, which is one of the possibilities that could take place. I guess that's what happened under Jones. Under this case, what happened was a different form of activity that shows a guilty mind, and that is handing off the drugs to someone else.
And only in the NFL do we see 300-pounders bolt.
Well, that's probably why he didn't do that. So,
want to save the rest of your time?
Your Honor, I'll save the 1 or 2 minutes left, yes. Thank you.
Good afternoon. The police, the court. I think Mr. Goff and I agree on the basic facts of the case and on the basic issue, and that is when did the detention occur under Chesternut and this court's decision in Jones. Under Hodari D, which this court rejected in Jones, the detention did not occur until the police physically grabbed hold of the defendant. But that, Hodari D, is not the rule of Delaware. The focus is rather, did the police do something prior to prior to the defendant tried to hand off the drugs that could be construed as the initiation of a Fourth Amendment detention? In this case, I submit that had the defendant not tried to hand off the drugs to this other individual and had kept on walking, we would not be here regardless of what the police had done afterwards, because at that point they did not have a reasonable articulable suspicion. What they have is an anonymous tip, man with gray pants selling drugs, a little bit better than Jones, and that was a crime identified, but just marginally. They arrived, yes, there's a man with gray pants, but anybody could, you know, call in a nuisance call. Of course, anybody could see him there. evasive action under Wardlow, something to consider, certainly not determinative, but it's not a headlong flight, but at least when he sees the police car drive by, he turns and starts to walk in the other direction. So there's a little bit there, but certainly not a reasonable suspicion. The defendant ignoring the police when they call out to them, again, that does not, he has a right to do that. You can't base reasonable suspicion on a defendant simply exercising his constitutional right to ignore the police and continue on his way. Of course, the police are going
to relate to when the seizure occurred.
I'm sorry?
How does that relate to when the seizure occurred?
This, my argument is that the seizure has not occurred yet. With the police asking him the question, sir.
The seizures can occur without reasonable suspicion, and they can occur with reasonable suspicion.
If a seizure occurs without reasonable suspicion, then the drugs are suppressed.
I understand that. Perhaps I'm not on the right issue, but I thought the issue was when did a seizure occur?
Yes.
Because from that point, you would determine whether there was reasonable suspicion to detain him.
Yes.
Are you equating seizure and detention as the same thing?
Oh, so seizure and detention, yes. Yes, in this case. Under Jones, the police need not physically detain a defendant for a seizure to occur.
Right.
Under Hodari D, that the defendant must either, or the suspect must either submit or be physically seized. Under Jones and Chesternut, it's the officer's show of authority that would communicate to a reasonable person that he is not free to go about his business. In this case, the state's position is that even repeatedly asking, and I think the key is asking the defendant if he would talk to them. Sir, I think Heather, Officer Brown's testimony was that Officer Villaverde said, sir, can we talk to you for a minute? That was it. They never said, stop where you are. They never said, as in Jones, get your hands out of your pocket. That was the first thing out of the officer's mouth in Jones, get your hands out of your pocket. Obviously, a show of authority that would communicate that, hey, you know, I'm not free. I better get my hands out of my pockets. Jones continued to, or in this case, Mr. Ross continued to walk on, continued to ignore the police, and it was not until he tried this handoff to the other individual that the police had now a reasonable suspicion that this defendant was, in fact, in possession of drugs, that the tip had been correct. And as he attempted to hand off the drugs, Officer Brown said, stop. And then a second or two later, grabbed him, of course. But at the moment Officer Brown said, stop, that was a command from a police officer. That is when the seizure occurred. And it is the state's position that the Superior Court judge was correct in saying that's when the seizure occurred, and also saying at that point the police did have a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity afoot, that the defendant was in possession of drugs, a cupped hand, trying to hand off the drugs to somebody else, the other person going, no, no. At that point, the police were justified in grabbing hold of the defendant, and then, of course, the drugs.
But you agree that if the seizure took place after two, sir, may we talk to yous, and I mean plural, phrase, not Brooklynese, use. When the 300-pound man walking away heard the police officers say that twice, in uniform, coming toward him, it's the state's position that a reasonable person would not believe that they are seized for the purpose of detention under the law.
That is the state's position, yes, sir.
A 300-pounder would feel free to continue walking on until the police officers managed to catch up with him.
So he could continue walking.
If they wanted to stop him.
He could continue walking. He could say to them, I'm sorry, I'm busy, I'm not going to stop, I'm not going to talk to you. He can continue doing that. And if the police go beyond, then you simply...
Well, he may have been physically able to do that, but the point in my mind, anyway, at this second is, would a reasonable person believe that he was free to walk away from the police under those circumstances?
Yes. Yes. Under the law... as it is, asking to speak with someone does not constitute a sufficient show of authority. It's not a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. Simply say, I don't want to talk to you, and walk on.
So to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, Mr. Goff argues that the police get one free, can we talk to you, sir, but anything after that constitutes a seizure. Your position, or a detention, I would say, your position is that the police can ask that question till the cows come home, but it, legally it's a non-event, and the only important event was that the police, at the time they saw the attempted standoff, said stop. That was the moment of detention.
That was the moment of detention. There was no order here. It has to be a verbal order. That would be my bright line rule.
All right. Let me give you a different hypothetical. Let's say the police are following this man and saying, can we speak to you? Can we speak to you? And the person stops. Because arguably he thinks he's got no choice, because even though they're saying, can we speak to you, he figures, you know, I'm cooked, I've got to stop here and do whatever they want me to do or answer their questions or whatever. So the defendant stops and the police then search him or whatever and find the contraband. At that point, they've got no reasonable articulable suspicion, supposedly, to justify that. Do we have anything in our lexicon of cases where we could take some comfort in knowing that, yeah, there are people who are asked, can we speak to you, can we speak to you, and they do ignore the police and nothing more happens? Or alternatively, that there are people who are asked, can we speak to you, and they're stopped, and then the motion to suppress is granted. In other words, we're trying to figure out what a person would expect when the police come toward you and say, can we speak to you, can we speak to you? Does that mean to a normal person, that's it, I better stop, because they're not going to leave me alone, and I've basically been detained? You're saying, no, of course that isn't what it means. But we don't have any, or at least I'm not aware of any case law that kind of demonstrates that people have been allowed to walk away, or alternatively that they have stopped and then at the motion to suppress have said, well, I thought I had no choice. I had to stop because they asked me, can we speak to you? Do we have anything like that from other cases?
Well, in the first instance, of course, there would never be a case if the person just kept on walking away. The police would never discover. How many times that happens? Probably not very many, but I certainly couldn't say, because it would never make its way into court.
Well, how many times do you think people on the street believe when the police officer says to them multiple times, stop, I want to talk to you, that they're actually free to walk away from a uniform? Two uniformed police officers.
Well, I think most of the time people will stop and they will ask what's going on.
And they will stop because they believe that that's a sufficient show of authority that they're commanded to stop.
Or they believe it's their civic duty. I mean, I don't know why they stop. All I'm saying is when the police say, can I talk to you, as opposed to get your hands out of your pocket or stop in the name of the law or whatever, but that...
As you explain the case, Mr. Donovan, help me understand the difference between the United States Supreme Court's Terry distinction of by means of physical force or show of authority. What to you, under your construct, would constitute a show of authority?
A command to stop. I think that's the simplest bright-line rule, a command to stop or a command to do something. In this case, when Officer Brown said, stop trying to hand off those drugs. Stop what you're doing, I think is what she said. That is a command. That is a show of authority. That is a show of authority. But simply asking to talk, I don't think is sufficient. Now, what the man on the street or the woman on the street is going to do when an officer comes up and says, may I talk to you, is 99 times out of 100 is probably say, sure.
Well, is your focus on what a sensible, reasonable, bright-line rule should be? And that certainly is attractive in that sense. Or is your focus on... You believe that's what a reasonable person would think, that there is a distinction, there should be a distinction, a rational distinction in their mind between two uniformed police officers walking toward them saying, I want to talk to you, and you keep on walking, and they say, sir, may we talk to you, or sir, I want to talk to you, and two uniformed police officers walking towards you while you're walking away saying, stop. Mm-hmm. I think the ordinary reasonable person would understand that that's the distinction.
I think this court in Jones, in rejecting the Hodari D and what's going on in the person's mind, basically, this court in Jones has said we're going to stick with Chesternut because the focus there is on what the police do. What did the police do? That's what we're going to focus on. We're not going to look at whether the defendant decides to ignore the officer, whether the defendant runs, what's going through the defendant's mind. We're going to focus on what the police do under the standard of Chesternut. You know, did the police do something to constitute a Fourth Amendment seizure? And I think, you know, quite frankly, I mean, I thought Hodari D, frankly, was a wonderful case when it first came out, but I certainly have since then seen the value of taking that other very objective approach of let's just focus on what the police do and not worry about what the defendant does. And I think that's the certainly the chief advantage of the Chesternut Jones type of analysis.
Where does the subjective analysis of what the defendant may have believed the police were doing.
Well, that's why
fall between what the police do and what the defendant does. Where does that mens rea or that subjective view of what a reasonable person would have believed come into play?
Well, that again is I suppose under Fourth Amendment law the one area in which the courts have traditionally not wanted to go into is the mens rea area. The mens rea of the police, are there motive pure, Wren versus United States, and the mens rea of a defendant. So there is that reasonable person standard, which is supposedly an objective one. But whether that reasonable person exists or not, I don't know. I mean, Your Honor said how many people are actually going to continue on walking like this fellow did. And Your Honor's right, very few. They're going to stop. You know, if an officer in uniform, or especially two, go up and you know, start following him and say, sir, can I talk to you? You know, 99% of the people are going to say, oh, okay, I better talk. Unfortunately, there are a few like Mr. Ross who continue walking and try to get rid of the drug, as was the case with the defendant in Michigan v. Chesternut. Rather than just continue what he was doing, which was jogging along the street, he tried to get rid of the packets. Of drugs as he was jogging along. Again, similar to this one, this defendant here. And again, had Mr. Ross just continued walking along and had he not tried to get rid of the drug in his possession, again, we would not be here. Because regardless of what the police would have done, and I think this is answers Justice Berger's question about how about those people who stop and they find him, the police wouldn't have had. If the police could have searched him, could have found the drugs, and all I could say to them, well, you got the drugs off the street, but we can't prosecute this case because at the time you searched this defendant, you had no reasonable suspicion, let alone probable cause to do it. So this case is not going to get prosecuted. We just can't do it. You know, you didn't wait long enough. You didn't wait for him to do something stupid, like try to get rid of the drugs.
How would you state the holding in Jones? What do you believe the holding to have been in Jones?
The holding in Jones is that the focus is on the police officer's actions in determining when a seizure occurs or a detention. A detention or a seizure, when the Fourth Amendment kicks in. And in Jones, that was when the officer said, get your hands out of your pockets. Now, in that case, the state argued, foolishly, I argued it, it was probably not a good case to broach it, but I argued Hodari D because Jones turned around and started walking away. I said, well, this is like Hodari D where the defendant just ran, ignored the officer. And this court said, no, we're not going to adopt the Hodari D standard, in which case the evidence would have come in because the officer grabbed Jones and there was a struggle and the drugs came, or Jones threw the drugs just before the officer grabbed him. Yes. Threw the drugs away just before the grabbing, which made it a Hodari D case. This court said, no, the Fourth Amendment kicked in when the officer said, get your hands out of your pockets. That's when the Fourth Amendment seizure occurred. And then what followed was the fruit of the poisonous tree. Here I am saying a Fourth Amendment seizure did not occur when Officer Villaverde said, sir, can we talk with you for a minute, even repeatedly.
That's different than get your hands out of your pockets because.
I'm sorry.
That's different than get your hands out of your pockets
yes.
because.
Because it's not an order. That's the only distinction, reasonable distinction, rational distinction that I can come up with. The how many times do you ask distinction? I can't see, you know, three times, four times. You know, at some point, a Fourth Amendment seizure occurs. But an order, do something. Stop. Get your hands out of your pockets. Put your hands over your head. Assume the position. You know, these are obviously orders from the police, a sufficient show of authority to any individual that, hey, you know, I am now under control of the police.
So the distinction is between a police request and a police command, correct?
Yes.
And your argument is that what the police requested here, although admittedly couched as a request, could not be reasonably interpreted as a demand.
It was not a demand. The police could very well have said, stop and answer our questions. That would be a command, certainly. These officers, I think, knowing that at this point they simply did not have enough and wanted to talk to them, so maybe something will develop. I think it's good police work. Quite frankly, it's like the officers in Michigan v. Chesterton. They knew they didn't have enough just because they saw what looked like a drug transaction and this guy started jogging down the street. They said, we'll just drive along beside them, get them nervous, see what happens. And the United States Supreme Court said, well, they didn't do anything to signify that this defendant was not free to keep on jogging along. I mean, they spooked him, certainly, and he got rid of the drugs, which is probably what the point of the whole exercise was, but they didn't do anything.
Well, it doesn't have to be just that they have to have an order. If they said, sir, can we talk to you with guns drawn, that would be a pretty clear signal.
I'm sorry. Yes, certainly you can physically indicate that you are not free to leave, that this is an official police action, you are now in police custody. Certainly. So we can talk to you with a gun drawn. Certainly that would accomplish the same thing, definitely.
They held up a badge beyond their uniform and say, sir, may we talk to you?
This is what
I
was...
Is that a show of authority or is that a command?
That is really a problem, Barry, when the police are going around without the uniforms on. And I was like, you know, this is going to come up. And I don't know what the answer is, but when some, you know, plainclothes cops goes, you know, sir, may I talk to you? You know, I don't know what the answer to that is.
Why is it different than having a uniform?
Well, the uniform is just there. You know, you're worried. You go in for a cup of coffee.
Why is it there? It's there to demonstrate that the person wearing it has the authority.
That it is.
It comes with the uniform.
It is indeed. And maybe just showing the badge is not enough. But it's certainly more than simply being there. I mean, an officer in uniform goes into Dunkin' Donuts and orders a cup of coffee. That's not a show of authority. An undercover officer does not go and sit down, throw a badge, and say, cup of coffee. Now, to me, there's a difference there. But I think that's more of a problem area. I don't have any problem with police being in uniform. At any rate, if there's no further questions, I think I've made my position clear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly, 1 minute and 58 seconds. A few comments concerning Mr. Donovan's argument. He seemed to indicate, Your Honor, that a bright line command to stop, at least at one point in time, that was what he indicated would be the appropriate standard. And I think that the standard that's set forth in Jones envisions a lot more flexible interpretation of what a demand or show of authority would be. And I think under these circumstances, we have what is an equivalent to a demand. And going back to some of the hypotheticals that were given to me, I believe Justice Ridgely stated the hypothetical of a person standing still. We have that hypothetical. We have the facts of this case where a person is 30 to 40 feet away and followed by a police officer. And I would submit that possible other hypotheticals where an officer would be requesting
and I put that in quotation marks, a person to stop could be, the officer could be following for 3 blocks making that request, or for a mile down the roadway. And the question, I guess, presented is at what point is the court going to say we cannot condone a person, a police officer, having this type of contact or showing this type of authority to someone without reasonable suspicion? Are we going to allow a person to essentially be harassed into conduct that's going to form the basis for reasonable suspicion? Mr. Donovan called it good police work. I would submit to the, Your Honor, that the reason why it's good police work in this case is because the gentleman had drugs. And as Your Honors have pointed out in your opinions, and I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Goff. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.